Welcome to Clause 8, the voice of IP. Clause 8 is part of IP Watchdog and sponsored by Heredy, the go-to firm for the Patent 300 for patent preparation and prosecution. And if you enjoyed this podcast, tell your friends you heard from us, and please leave a 5-star rating wherever you're listening now. And now, here's your host, Eli Mazur.
Today, we're lucky to be joined by Robert Stoll. He was the patent commissioner at the USPTO during the time that the American Invents Act was passed and implemented at the USPTO. He's also part of the first family of patent law. Bob's younger brother, Thomas Stoll, works in senior roles on Capitol Hill on patent issue. His sister-in-law, your younger brother's wife, Kiara Stoll, is a judge, of course, on the Federal Circuit. Bob told me that your wife worked for WIPO, which is the World Intellectual Property Organization, so not only in every branch of U.S. government, but also on an international level, you had some involvement of your family. Thank you so much for joining Clause 8, and maybe we could just start there. How did that happen?
Well, I think that the reason everybody's got into intellectual property issues in my family was because my father was a patent attorney.
Oh, wow.
He worked for a firm called LeBlanc and Schur for many, many years. And he actually, back then, was partners with Don Dunner, who went to Finnegan. So I think that the only acceptable degrees in my family were engineering and law. And all of us have engineering degrees, and most of us have law degrees. I have two other siblings, both of whom have worked at the Patent and Trademark Office for some time. And my daughter is a copyright expert working for the recording industry.
Wow. So your dad, obviously, I'm guessing he loved what he did, and he wanted his kids to do that. Any advice or no?
He at least thought that a livable wage could be earned undertaking
I
those
see.
Efforts. He wouldn't be stuck with us for the rest of our lives.
How did you all end up reaching the highest levels of in whatever you worked?
We did different things. And you know, my brother has been at many firms, and he's actually at a company right now, and he was on the Hill. My sister worked at the PTO. Her husband's one of the partners at Nixon and Vanderhei. Kara went to GW at night, I think it was GW, or could have been Georgetown.
Yeah.
I think GW, and she became a judge after having been a managing partner at Finnegan. And all of us basically went our different ways, which makes for a very interesting Thanksgiving when we have different opinions on different policy issues.
So I was going to ask, do you still talk about patent law? Does it
all the time? All the time. And most of my friends are in patent law. You know, after years and years of being involved in it and going to meetings like the AIPLA, where I met you, or some of these other meetings, you begin to develop a relationship with other people in the community. And I can now honestly say many of them are my friends that I like to see even outside of AIPLA or any of these other activities.
Are there any secrets that you share about how to succeed?
Well, there are many secrets. I mean, you know, here's my main idea with respect to succeeding. Be nice to everyone. I mean, I really think that's the key to success. Go in with a smile, be nice to everyone. Even the lowly secretary can sink your career. Be nice. And you always feel better being nice anyway. So do it. And that is really what I think is the key to success. I think I rose up to that level because I was nice to everyone at the Patent and Trademark Office. And even now, you know, I can call over there and say, so what's the best way to do this? And they'll tell me. I mean, that's how to just be nice.
That's great advice. And you obviously mentioned that some of your family members worked at the USPTO. I know you and your brother started out, for example, as examiners and
Judge
Kara Stoll.
The judge did too.
But they left into private practice. What made you stay there for 30 years?
I had a negotiated agreement with my wife who did not want me working in a law firm situation. And she agreed to work outside the home if I agreed not to take a law firm position. So that went on until I reached retirement age, and by then she was fine.
She didn't want you to work too much, but I imagine you probably ended up working just as much at the USPTO.
Yes, I think that the hours were bad there too. But she was fine with that. Wonderful. She had a career on the Hill for many, many years. She was the chief of staff for three consecutive congressmen from the same area. And then after that, she was the Washington rep to WIPL.
You mentioned your advice about being nice, but I talked to a lot of examiners who, or former examiners who seem very nice, and some of them end up in really cool roles at the USPTO, like you did, and some of them just feel stuck. They end up leaving, and you know they don't look as fondly at their career and opportunities they had there. Is there any other advice you would have, maybe to current examiners?
Yeah. I'm like them. I don't think I wanted to be an examiner all of the time. So when I had the opportunity to do details, I did all types of details. I went over to the academy and I taught courses at the academy. The irony is, I became the agency lead for the raising charitable contributions from the agency, and that brought me into contact with what was the equivalent of the director of the Patent and Trademark Office, because it's an important initiative. And by having experience with me, he felt comfortable with me. He put me in as chief of staff, and it took off from there.
At least from what I hear, is that it's sometimes very hard to get those details.
I don't think it's that hard. If you don't get one, get another. Just take, like I said, it was charitable contributions.
Okay.
Not my teaching capabilities at the academy that got me into roles. I mean, the first one I had after that was the head of legislation and international affairs. So I would say, just get a breadth of experience, because you don't know where it's going to take you.
Whatever opportunity there is.
Absolutely. Yes.
So you mentioned some of the roles that you were in before you became commissioner. Is there one that was kind of stood out as your maybe favorite?
Yeah. I loved being the head of the Office of Legislation and International Affairs. I got to represent the United States in negotiations in bilateral and multilateral. I went to WIPO to negotiate treaties with the PLT, the Patent Law Treaty. I did a lot of things along those lines. And I also interfaced with the Hill all the time on any legislation related to any part of intellectual property, and loved it. I mean, I thought that, you know, I would try to get the system in the form that it was best for the United States. And that was my goal all the time then, and it's still my goal now.
Is there a point where you started thinking, well, maybe one day I'll become commissioner of U.S. patents?
Never occurred to me. Never. I wanted to be back into the position of the legislation and international affairs. And when Obama came in, I kind of put my name in the hat. But apparently that position was already taken before I put my name in the hat. And so I was kind of not happy and figured, okay, I'll just continue doing what I'm doing. And then Nick Gadisi, who was a previous commissioner for patents, came to me and said, Bob, you need to do this. This is, you know, you shut up and take the job. And I really respect the man. So, you know, I did. And I really liked doing it. I was kind of surprised. I thought that the position had some problems under, you know, Dudas beforehand. And I thought there needed to be a complete overhaul. And my goal with respect to that was that I would try to get the core to follow what I call the lead of being helpful to applicants, to each other, to management, and I imposed upon management the obligation to treat their examiners with respect and understanding. And I really think that that helped move it.
And obviously you worked under Director Kappos. I'm sure you knew him somewhat, but did you have a close relationship or no?
I did not know him at all, which is kind of surprising since he was chief counsel for IBM. But in the short time he was there, I got to know him, and I think he heard a lot of things about me. And he was an awesome director. I really respect him. The only thing I've got to say is he still thinks I work for him. So, I mean, we probably communicate every week, and I help him out, and he helps me out. But he's wonderful. He's just a wonderful guy.
It's good you're both in private practice, so I guess that makes it easier. So you mentioned that, you know, there was a previous administration where your things didn't work like you wanted to. But by that point, I'm sure you probably grew up maybe having already strong views on patent issues and how things should be. What was it like adjusting to different administrations.
It's very hard to adjust. If you can remember, John Dudas got us into the Tapas situation about claims and continuations. And I was very much not on that side. So it was tough for me to kind of have to toe the line on some of these policy issues that I thought were ill-conceived. And, you know, really what I did was, in all of my iterations of different jobs, I interfaced with the bars all the time and, you know, kind of asked what the bar was interested in doing. And that's where I took my leads with respect to positions to take.
And somebody who hasn't worked in government those levels, what is this like? You kind of share your opinions and then they don't agree with you. And then you kind of say, well, there will be a better day when I...
toe the line. Yeah. I mean, you know, but you keep testing it. I think that any good leader would expect someone who disagrees with them to put some ideas on the table. But when your boss speaks, game over. I mean, it's, you know, that's the marching orders. And I went forward with the direction that I was given. But I can't. It's like Tourette's. I have to say what I think. And I did, and I always did. At the management meetings or the policy meetings, I was always putting it on the table.
During that time, you also saw different relationships between the director of the USPTO and maybe the head of a Commerce Department in the White House. Can you talk about how does that relationship work?
Well, the policy functions of the Patent and Trademark Office are still held at the Department of Commerce, if you look at 35 USC. It's either two or three, I think. So the management of the office is supposed to be in the hands of the director of the Patent and Trademark Office, while policy emanates from Commerce and not just Commerce. It's always OSTP, the Office of Science and Technology Policy, the National Economic Council, Office of Management and Budget. So everybody weighs in with respect to policy issues there. And the autonomy of the director is not what people think it is on the outside who are not familiar with it. But it's still an extremely important role, and it is a strong voice in policy that advocates for what the patent, trademark, and copyright policy should be in the United States.
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because a lot of times, you know, people attribute whatever happens with regards to patent policy is like, oh, that patent director, blah, blah. But you're saying regardless of administration, the people who have a say in what patent policy is, it's not like they're sitting there quietly.
Correct. It's not your own voice. I mean, any director of the PTO has to work in their administration and carry forward what becomes the policy of the president. So they're not free hands with respect to implementing their ideas. And you just have to recognize that. But there are, you know, I think one of the most important pieces of being the director is being an advocate. And I think when you've got a good argument for your positions, you are much more likely to have them implemented than if you are just rote putting things down for change.
As I mentioned in the beginning, the most significant event during your time as commissioner was the passage of the AIA, which created the PTAB. You know, from my viewpoint, it came about mainly because of this narrative that the USPTO was granting low-quality patents and these patent trolls were kind of taking advantage of that to kind of shake down businesses to pay them. Did you agree that was the impetus for the AIA?
You know, first of all, Eli, I don't know what a troll really is. I mean, when let's look at the company where Dave Kapos came from, IBM. IBM files the most patents in the United States on a yearly basis. They don't actually undertake the efforts related to many of their patents. They just don't do it. They have core areas where they function and they invent in all particular areas. If they are not actually operating in some of those areas, they're like an NPE with respect to those patents. So it's very difficult, you know, to make a pure argument with respect to that. Secondly, I think that it's important that there be a secondary market for patents because it permits the companies or the inventors to sell them to other companies to enforce them. I think that that's a very important part of our economy. For example, if a company goes bankrupt but has a bunch of patents that are very good patents, shouldn't some purchaser be able to, you know, underwrite that and be able to license those particular patents? I think the answer to that is yes. This is all based upon what I think is the most important issue with respect to patents, and that's the quality of the patents coming out of the patent and trademark.
Would you agree with that narrative about patent trolls, even if you don't buy it, is really kind of what was the impetus behind the AI?
I do agree that the narrative kind of fanned the desire for the AIA itself. Yes, I do think that kind of allowed the doors to get opened. And, you know, it takes 5 or 6 years to get any major patent built through. There was the AIPA that I think was in 1999, and then the AIA out in 2011, effective in 2012.
You know, I was putting some presentation together and I came across a White House graphic. It actually had a patent troll on it from that time. And I was kind of surprised that it was that.
And Eli, still hear about it now. Yeah. I still hear the idea that trolls are causing problems now. And I don't buy into that.
Well, let's talk about the patent quality piece of it. Ooh. You spent 30 years of your career at the USPTO. I'm sure a big portion of that time was focused on what we would consider improving patent quality. What do you think about that piece of the narrative?
In my opinion, it is the most important part of examination is to be able to get the correct decision. Now, I recognize that there's a perception that the EPO does a better job. I don't buy into that. I think the PTO does a great job. I think there are some problem patents and there are some problem issues. There's no question about that. But I think the quality is not bad coming out of the Patent and Trademark Office. That being said, it can always be improved. We can get better quality out of the Patent and Trademark Office. I think a lot of the quality is driven by search. I think the search actually makes the underlying understanding of what the inventive concept and what the claims are directed to. So I think that's very important. But I also think training the examiners in the law, training the examiners in patent prosecution, continually monitoring what's going on and updating your guidelines and your training materials at the Patent and Trademark Office is important. I'm not sure if more time is needed or not. I think that's a decision for for the United States in general, whether we think it's worthwhile to pay a lot more. I personally believe that we should be changing our fee schedule and move some of our fees up front for the non-micro and small entities so that large corporations are paying more at the beginning and not abandoning before paying their first maintenance fee. So I do think that there's many things related to fees, funding, and quality that can be improved.
And it's obviously very hard to measure patent quality in the abstract, but one of the arguments that you hear is, well, we know patent quality is bad because so many patents get invalidated at the PTAB or the courts. Do you buy their argument that?
Let's be realistic. The patent office issues, 500,000 patents a year, something along those lines? I think it's probably up. But, you know, it very small number of patents actually go to PTAB or actually go to court. Very small. I think the percentages are under 3%, something along those lines. So I don't know that the vast numbers out there are bad. I think that most, you know, I've seen the work inside. I've reviewed the work. Most of what I see is very good. I also see that Europeans and Americans come out with the same ultimate conclusion as to whether something is patentable or not patentable. They use different references. I think the Europeans are much more happy to use a European reference, and the Americans are much happier to use a U.S. patent. But I find that the results are the same.
You saw the whole AIA debate play out. Obviously, you played a relatively close role. Is there anything that you could have think that people who represent patent owners could have done differently to have a debate play out differently, to have a different system in place at the end?
Look, I think the big thing that the AIA created was the post-grant procedures, the IPRs, the the covered business methods and post G's, PG's. And I think that the intent was that that would be revisited and modified and improved because it was a brand new procedure that was being used frequently now, but wasn't in place at the time we passed it. So I thought it was a good idea. There are many things that I think can be done to improve it. So I don't think the patent owners were that much harmed by the passage. I think we may have done a little bit of disservice on implementing, recognizing that the PTO at the beginning had nobody familiar with the procedures, did not have enough judges at the PTAB up there that fully trained. And, you know, as they work through things, I think we should have modified even more.
So if you look at the implementation, obviously, 20 hindsight, it seems like every decision that was made about how to implement the AIA almost came out in favor of the patent challengers versus patent owners. You mentioned some of these things that obviously you don't have a perfect view of how that would play out, but was there anything else involved? Was it just the administration? That's how they wanted to implement that at the time?
There was lack of experience with respect to those type of procedures and how they would be used. I mean, I'm sure you're aware that PTAB was supposed to be a cheap, quick alternative to litigation. What I find now is whenever I bid on a litigation, I'm bidding on an IPR as well. So, I mean, it seemed to be adjunct now mostly and not an alternative. And I think, you know, there may have been some questions with respect to presumptions of validity. I think that, you know, there's a question now as to whether it should be one judge instituting and three other ones actually holding the trial. I mean, there's many different permutations. And I will say that there have been changes as we go along. Many of them can be done by rule. Remember, it provided substantive rulemaking to the director, which is kind of unusual at the PTO. And there have been some changes. I don't think it's now what Rader would call the killing fields of patents, but it still has areas where it can be improved.
And I think you're kind of hinting at what Director Iancu did. He made a lot of changes to kind of recalibrate some of those rules on the topics that you mentioned. But right now, under the current administration, we're seeing kind of it undoing what Director Iancu did, especially when it comes to discretionary denials. I mean, what do you think of those?
Well, I personally, I think that there's a big issue with FINTIV. There's no question about that. I am not sure exactly how to come out, but I don't think that all of the PTAB filings, the IPRs, need to go through the in process with respect to all claims. So I think there should be some sort of consideration, but we can't go overboard. I mean, you know, that's the problem.
Some observers are looking at this and they're saying each administration is coming in and they're kind of taking the PTAB to trying to align with the ideological views. There's less predictability. And, you know, I mean, what kind of impact do you think it has on the patent system that these rules can kind of swing the PTAB?
If you actually go through comment and rulemaking, it's not as easy to change things as people think. I mean, if you just implement your own rules without doing that, it is easy to change. And I don't like codifying a lot of things because things change. And as we can see, they get locked up in the House and the Senate and nothing happens. So I would rather there be some flexibility to modify rules as you learn more about their impact. But I also think you do need to go through comment and rulemaking, you know, official rulemaking, because it shouldn't be so easy to change. It should take some effort and comment from the community who's using the procedures.
One of the new powers that the director of the USPTO has is director review of patent PTAB decisions. What is your thoughts about how that has been playing out?
Well, it's funny you should ask about that. I have been reading recently that there have been no POPs in a long time. And, you know, I'm not sure that's good. I do believe that Director Vidal is looking at what type of procedures she should put in place. I think that's what should be done. I mean, they should be taking comments from the user community, reviewing them, you know, suggesting alternatives, and finding a solution that works for most.
You know, maybe I was somewhat naive, but I thought when they gave the director that power, I thought, well, the director is going to be very hesitant to use it because it would seem like arbitrary what cases she takes up or not. The current director seems somewhat active. The number of decisions taken under director review, has that surprised you?
No, but some of the specific conclusions have surprised me. I read Gene Quinn's comments yesterday with other people like James Carmichael. There was an event and there was definitely concern that things weren't going in the right direction, there is a particular case that...
Open Sky. Yeah.
Yes. That I think maybe she didn't get it right, but she's trying. I mean, you know, I understand what she was thinking. I just don't think that was the right decision.
One last question about the PTAB. Obviously, Open Sky is a kind of a situation where a third party gets involved in the PTAB process. You kind of mentioned that the whole idea of a PTAB was to kind of create a cheaper, easier way, alternative to litigation. But now you have these third parties. Some of them maybe are well-meaning. Some of them are maybe less well-meaning, like some say Open Sky was. Do you think generally should third parties be allowed to just challenge patents at the PTAB?
Currently they are. I mean, that's how it was written. I remember when that was being contemplated. Do you have to be a real party in interest to file at the agency with respect to PTAB? The answer is no. Should you be? I don't know. I mean, I'd like to see comments about that. I'd like to see testing the community about that. I want to see what people want to do about that. I'm not sure yet. What you shouldn't be able to do, in my opinion, is have several bites at the apple. I think that's harassment of the patent owner. And I think there should be more of a separation between what's done in IPR and what's done in court. Pick your venue.
And I think by that you mean estoppel, right? Once you get once a PTAB upholds a patent, you shouldn't get a right to kind of try again at the courts.
Right.
Yeah. So besides the implementation of the AA, I think something major that happened during your time as commissioner was really encouraging decreasing the patent application backlog by encouraging examiner interviews. Can you tell us about how did that initiative come about?
Well, I mean, when I started going through the numbers, when I came over to the commissioner's office and I looked at what was happening and why we had such a huge backlog, I actually thought the biggest problem was that a lot of the cases were slipping through the cracks and they were just not in a code that would make anyone aware that they needed to have an action on them. So I undertook an effort to kind of get rid of all of that dead wood out of the patent and trademark office and act on them. And I thought that was very important. The part dealing with having examiners interviews, I always think that's great. I mean, I think it's fantastic. I even was very supportive of the first office action interview prior to the first office action. I think that, first of all, you're establishing a relationship with the examiner who's handling your application. Sometimes there's a miscommunication or a misunderstanding as to what the claims mean or the invention is. I think you can iron that out easily. I also think that people practicing in a particular area frequently have more applications in that subject matter area. So they're handling an application with an examiner who they're going to be dealing with for many, many years. So I think it's important to do an interview. I realize the first action interview pilot is no longer there, but there is an ability to have an interview if you want to. And I think it's brilliant, to be honest.
There's some proposed legislation and a plan request for comments about the idea of transcribing all examiner interviews. What do you think is driving that proposal and any thoughts about it?
I'm sure because it was driving the idea back when I was doing the AIA, and it's litigation that's driving it. They find that they don't have enough record as to why there's an allowance, after an interview. I get it. But the prosecuting attorneys are not supportive of that because they recognize that the, you know, the examiners are not used to litigation standards or techniques, or, you know, they want more freedom to negotiate. I think, again, rulemaking. Let's see what everybody comes out. Let's see what the comments are. I think you're going to have a split between prosecuting attorneys and litigating attorneys. The litigating attorneys are more interested in a recorded interview. The prosecuting attorneys are not. Maybe we can find some sort of hybrid that puts more information down than the current interview summary form requires.
A lot of times what happens during an interview is that an examiner kind of tells you something that's not in the office action, right? For whatever reason, he didn't feel comfortable putting it down or something. And don't you think transcribing the interviews would completely chill examiner interviews? Or
I don't know. First of all, it's recording. I mean, I don't think the examiner should not be telling you things in the interview that they're not able to write into their actions. So I have a problem with that in the first place. But I also think, you know, you should be communicating freely and honestly. And I think it's important to record something. I rarely put that agreement was reached when I was an examiner. I always wanted to think about it more and look more and maybe even search after I decided to not undertake the same rejection. So I rarely said that, but I've been a party where they actually say, your arguments are persuasive, we will allow the case. So I want to know what everybody's thinking before I move in that direction.
It's interesting you mentioned that because sometimes I see where actually an applicant and the examiner will reach an agreement during the interview, but the examiner still says no agreement reached in the interview summary, even though they described the agreement. And I think that's an effort to kind of, because examiners are nervous about saying, well, I agreed, but then they find something or something like that. I think the way the system works, I don't think it's a big issue, but it's kind of something that occurs to kind of, I think, tells you how some examiners think.
On this one, I agree with you. I think that they're, it's CYA for not saying that it's allowable. And I get that. But I also see where people make arguments for unexpected results or some sort of affidavit type of information. I make them file that in an affidavit. I want somebody to swear that there is unexpected results in this particular claim. And that makes me more comfortable. So if I used to hear that at an interview, I'd say, you know, give me a declaration under 132.
You know, I want to talk about some of the more broader, I guess, the patent policy developments that we've seen. You know, during the last administration, there was a sense that maybe some of the wins that the patent reform advocates were having were slowing down and that it was swinging towards a more patent-friendly direction. How do you think, did you view the last administration that way? And what do you think is the lasting impact on patent policy from the last administration?
Well, you know, I think Iancu did a very good job. I was impressed with him. I think he's a smart guy. I think he tried to make it a better system. I'm not sure I would agree with everything he did. I do have problems with his guidelines under 101, because if the courts say they're not going to help, then they're not going to help. I mean, it's like, so I can get a patent out of the patent office, but I can't enforce it in court. That doesn't do my clients any good.
Well, I think you're just trying to help the courts, but
no effort.
They refuse to help.
Give it to something else. But I liked him. I thought he was good, and I thought he was thoughtful. I think, again, you need to get everybody's input. There is not going to be substantive legislation without more agreement between the different sides, the patent owners and others. And I think more and more of that is necessary.
You know, I want to talk about the current administration, and not just at the patent office. I think one of the first decisions that this administration did was to waive the IP rights for COVID-19 vaccines. I mean, what do you think overall current administration's approach to IP issues?
I don't ever do overall. I go issue by issue. And on that one, I was not happy with the position the administration took. I don't think it's effective. I believe that the pharmaceutical industries went and flooded the least developed and less developed countries with vaccines. I believe that there is a lot of know-how technology involved in the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines. And I believe that the right way was for the United States to find a way to help to make sure that everybody could get the vaccines. I think that's the way to do it, and not to put it on the back of the inventor, because I want the next cure. I want that cure for cancer coming down the pipe. And I want them investing, and I don't want them hurt so that they're not investing anymore. That being said, I also don't want the pharmaceutical companies to be abusive with respect to they do. So I didn't agree with the mechanism they did it. And I've noticed recently that the United States is not advocating for an expansion to go into diagnostics at this point. And that's causing some concern, but I think that's the right decision too.
You know, you mentioned one of your favorite roles at the USPTO was kind of representing head of legislation and international affairs, representing really America's patent system at WIPO. For many years, I think America was seen as the beacon of patent rights and the IP rights. Other countries looked towards America kind of when developing their own patent policies and so forth. With that COVID-19 IP waiver, I saw a little bit of a shift. You saw these European countries kind of saying, no, that's kind of that's out of hand to waive IP rights. I mean, what do you think, kind of impact do you think it has?
Okay, first of all, when I was negotiating, I never negotiated based upon the USPTO practice or practice in the United States. I always negotiated as to what was the best practice worldwide to go forward. For example, I'm not a big fan of our restriction practice. I would much rather use the European standard or the equivalent there. I think so. I would go in that direction. And I think that's a very important thing to do. We should be looking not for what our domestic methods and laws require, but for what is the best policy worldwide for being able to undertake this. As to the TRIPS waiver, I personally believe that the administration was trying to curry favor with India and was kind of giving them a gift there, not expecting anything to happen, recognizing the WTO can't agree on a time for lunch, much less some sort of major thing. But they went forward, and I don't see a major effect of what was done, and I don't want to see continued camel's nose under the tent when they are looking at issues like climate change and maybe subjecting those types of patents to some sort of compulsory license or waiver.
So I want to talk about Congress for a bit. I think over the last 2 years, you know, one of the big events there was that Senator Leahy kind of took over the subcommittee, the Senate subcommittee on IP. What kind of impact do you think that has had, I guess, on the how patent policy has developed?
Well, I mean, I think that Senator Leahy listens to constituents that he thinks have the right positions, but he's leaving. And I think a lot of it is going to fall to Senator Coons, who I think is really good on patent issues. I don't know what's going to happen to Senator Tillis, although I think he's also been good now that Brad Walz has left. But I think that some of Leahy's ideas are good, but we'd have to go through issue by issue. And I don't accept anybody's full menu of changes. I look at them and how they fit in with everything else.
Imagine, I think you mentioned some of the things, I guess, that could be improved on the examination front. But imagine you were made an all-powerful U.S. Patent Commissioner for one day and you could change anything about U.S. patent policy. Is there anything that kind of sticks out to you that you think requires the most immediate attention?
I know some of my partners are not going to be happy, but I think the discovery part of patent litigation is way too costly. And I think we need to look at mechanisms for changing that, maybe taking a type of German model for discovery. I think that the costs are just way outweigh the benefits for that extensive discovery.
Any advice about how you've seen how, I'm sure, different parties try to influence how patent policy develops at the USPTO and Congress and so forth? Any advice about how to effectively do that?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Affiliate. I think that's the best way. Get involved in the AIPLA. Get on one of their committees. And make sure that your voice is joined by other voices. That really amplifies the positions you're trying to take. And it's what I do in order to advocate the policies that I think are the best for the United States. So I get involved in, I'm involved in the amicus committee. I'm involved in a legislative committee. I'm involved in several task forces. And it's because I think that joining with like-minded people is the best way to move any type of policy forward.
Anyone, I guess, that stands out to you in D.C. who's been particularly effective at advocating on patent policy issues, any lobbyist or any organization?
I got to tell you, Suzanne Michel, who was working for Google, was really good. And then I think Susan Mann, who worked for Microsoft, was really good. So I think that there are some people out there who are just very, very good at what they do. And sometimes it's because they've got very strong backing from their company and the company's willing to put a lot of effort into a particular issue. And that changes depending upon the issue. There are other companies that are very involved in a particular patent issue and can really work it. And I think that's pretty healthy.
So, Bob, thank you so much for answering all of these questions. Is there anything else that I guess you would like Clausey's listeners think they should know?
I still think IP is the most important part of a driving economy. And I think that we need strong patent protection for economic growth and job creation, but it has to be limited at some point.
Good words to end on. Thank you so much, Bob.
Thank you, Eli. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Clause 8. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with others and leave a 5-star rating. I'd also like to thank my firm, Harity & Harity LLP, for their generous support. Clause 8 is produced by Great Feeling Studios and Brick Brewer. For more information, visit voiceofip.com. Thanks for listening.